I now call the remote meeting of the House Energy and Climate Finance and Policy Committee to order. Good morning, everyone, once again. Thank you for joining the remote meeting. We are operating under House Rule 10.01 today. And to begin the meeting and establish a quorum, the clerk will take the roll.
Chair Wagenius.
Present.
Representative Long.
Present.
Representative Swazinski.
He's muted.
Present.
Representative Akam.
Present.
Representative Baker.
Baker present.
Representative Bierman.
Present.
Representative Bow.
Present.
Representative Christensen.
Present.
Representative Garofalo.
Yes.
Representative Hornstein.
Present.
Representative Jordan.
Present.
Representative Mahoney. Representative Meckland.
Present.
Representative Nelson. Representative Stevenson.
Here.
Representative Mahoney.
Hold on.
And Representative Nelson. A quorum is present.
Thank you. The first thing on the agenda is approval of the minutes of April 23. Representative Long, would you move the minutes?
Be happy to. Madam Chair, I move the minutes from April 23rd.
All right. I hope everybody is unmuted for this. All those in favor of the minutes from April 23, 2020, say aye.
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 Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, the minutes are adopted. We are fortunate this morning to have a presentation from Commerce on two things they're working on, the Warm Homes and Healthy Air programs. And then we're going to represent, welcome Michelle Grancy. She's the director of the Minnesota State Energy Office. And we would like to hear her presentation. And folks, if you have questions, certainly use the raised hand function. Welcome.
Thank you. I am going to attempt to share my screen. All right. Is it all? Are you able to see the
yes.
Full
yes, we are. Good.
All right. Fantastic. Well, good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. I am Michelle Grancy, Director of the Minnesota State Energy Office within the Department of Commerce Energy Division. I have been with the department for 10 years. I am pleased to provide this informational update on the Minnesota Weatherization Assistance Program, along with details on two emerging programs, Healthy Air and Warm Homes. The Minnesota State Energy Office has three core drivers: to move market-ready emerging energy technologies into the market through sound technical assistance and energy information, to inform the Minnesota transformation to a clean energy economy through educational, project, and financial assistance, and finally, to reach the goal for energy equity and affordability by reducing the energy burden of all Minnesota residents to under 5% of their total annual income. This Minnesota Low-Income Weatherization Assistance Program is the main driver for this last goal. So meet the Weatherization Assistance Program, or WAP State Team, which is made up of one supervisor, a technical assistance specialist, a leveraging specialist, and 5 monitors to ensure that comprehensive weatherization takes place throughout the state. The Low-Income Weatherization Assistance Program has the mission to reduce energy costs for low-income families, particularly the elderly, people with disabilities, and children, by improving the energy efficiency of their homes through free-of-charge, comprehensive energy upgrades, while ensuring the health and safety of both the clients and the workers. Services include exterior wall and attic insulation, air leakage reduction, furnace, boiler, and water heater repair or replacement, and education on how to reduce household energy use, such as using a programmable thermostat. These services help reduce energy consumption, save money, and make sure homes are healthy and safe to live in. In fiscal year 2019, more than 2,000 household units statewide received services through the Weatherization Assistance Program. About 65% of these households served were in Greater Minnesota. The program itself is 43 years old. Innovation has been at the heart of the program since the beginning. In 1976, Weatherization Assistance Program, or what we call WAP, was established through Title IV of the Energy Conservation and Production Act. In the 70s, WAP was a simple program providing basic caulking and weather stripping to homes. In the 80s, as building science began evolving, the importance of insulation measures was recognized, as well as improving efficiency in heating systems. By the 1990s, and with technological advances from a Minnesota company, advanced energy audits with the Minnesota blower door began, which allowed for directed air sealing and a true house-as-a-system approach. In the early 2000s, then, WAP recognized the need for increased health and safety, improving ventilation, and recognizing the importance of maintaining dry homes. Then in 2009, the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act provided $5 billion nationally in additional funding to support jobs, spur economic growth, and expedite the weatherization of more low-income homes. For Minnesota, that meant on top of the approximately 1,400 homes that were served that year, at that time, another 20,000 were able to be served over 3 years. By the end of ARRA, then, the U.S. Department of Energy had established standardized work specifications nationwide for all work, as well as certifications for auditors and quality control inspectors. In 2017, Minnesota launched the Healthy Air Program. And finally, in 2020, we have now received approval to utilize solar as a measure within the Weatherization Assistance Program, thereby launching our WARM, or Weatherization Assistance Air Source Heat and Renewables for Minnesota Homes Program. We are also working to expand the Healthy Air Program to address all deferral measures within eligible households that are served. So why weatherization? Because weatherization works. It is a one-time infusion into a house that provides a permanent energy reduction of 30 to 40%. The health and safety of individuals, like this disabled farmer from Western Minnesota, is improved, and thereby housing stability for the individuals served is also increased. Commerce administers WAP, which is largely funded by the U.S. Department of Energy. In 2017, however, the Minnesota legislature appropriated funds for a new grant program to remove asbestos-laden vermiculite insulation in the homes of low-income Minnesotans. This program is known as Healthy Air, and it eliminates a serious health hazard while making these homes eligible to receive federally funded weatherization services to reduce energy costs. This picture is of asbestos, the cancer-causing material utilized in vermiculite insulation, a serious threat to many Minnesota residents. The Healthy Air program has been extremely successful, so today I will share just a bit about what has been accomplished and where we are headed next. While weatherization alone has had a significant impact on those served, there is a great barrier to accessing the program by those households where vermiculite insulation is present. Federal funds can be used to test for vermiculite and to provide weatherization services once it is safely removed, but we are not allowed to use federal funds to remove this hazardous material, and the costs are generally too expensive for low-income households to afford on their own. So vermiculite insulation being the major reason why an increasing number of otherwise eligible Minnesotans are denied weatherization services. In some parts of Minnesota, deferral rates are well over 54% of eligible dwellings, with vermiculite being the number one reason for this deferral. This is where Healthy Air, or the asbestos insulation remediation program, steps in. Healthy Air pays for removal of hazardous insulation in the homes of low-income Minnesotans, especially those most vulnerable due to age, illness, or disability. These homes are then able to receive weatherization services otherwise denied to them. Eligible households are identified via the existing network of 23 local service providers. Thanks to Minnesota and to the Minnesota legislature, this common deferral reason is starting to be addressed. With general funding of $150,000 each year, the initial Healthy Air program was launched 3 years ago. Each year, the funding is tied up very quickly to address the backlog of needed homes. The current program has completed 51 households since its inception, with an average cost of $8,429 per home. Because the work is done with the federal weatherization program, the department takes no administrative fee. All $150,000 goes into serving households. In addition, a team of state staff and local service providers are currently assessing emerging practices to reduce the overall cost of each project while maintaining the health and safety of occupants. Healthy Air meets a critical need for low-income Minnesotans, especially in our small towns and rural areas where this problem is most common. Currently, Healthy Air is focused solely on asbestos-laden vermiculite. In addition to asbestos, however, a number of other indoor air quality issues cause additional deferrals, again, up to 50% or more in parts of the state. In light of the current pandemic, where more people spend more time indoors, those in particular with respiratory illnesses are being hit even harder. In fact, prior to COVID-19, respiratory illnesses already ranked as the fourth highest expenditure category for total medical expenditures in the U.S. In the current pandemic, underlying health conditions, such as respiratory illnesses, have been seen to increase the mortality rate of all ages. In this light, energy equity, even more than ever, equals health equity. Addressing indoor air quality issues, such as mold and moisture and other asthma triggers, not only allows for weatherization to take place, but it can reduce medical bills and the drain that plays on everyone. When these issues are addressed, we know that individuals and families are healthier. We also know that housing is a social determinant of health, along with economic stability, increased educational success, social and community contacts, health and healthcare. We know that children of color and lower income children have higher rates of asthma at 20% of all children, 12% higher than the rest of the population. Attacking conditions that allow pests in by fixing leaky holes and roofs or poor foundations, these are not energy-related measures, and therefore the Department of Energy will not address them. By taking on these measures, though, through future Healthy Air expansion, we will make for more resilient homes and healthier families. We are working on partnerships with other agencies, foundations, et cetera, to identify funding opportunities to meet this need. The other initiative I wish to speak with you about today is the continued expansion of base energy saving efforts through the current U.S. DOE-sponsored WEP. This we have termed the Warm Homes Initiative. By continuing to innovate and expand services through weatherization, air source heat, and other emerging technologies, we can have a greater impact on each household served. The Department of Energy requires that all energy saving measures are cost effective and installed properly. Just as when weatherization added heating systems, a comprehensive review and approval process is required and has been required for adding solar electric systems. I'm pleased to share that solar as a WAP measure has been approved in Minnesota during this current program year. However, leverage funds are necessary to make the economics work. We are limited by USDOE to spend no more than $3,699 for each solar system. So we must pair with other dollars to be able to install solar. Installed cost for a 3.6 kW system has been coming in around $350 a watt. So on average, an additional $1,500 has been needed to pair with the DOE allocation. In the case of 5 pilot homes, solar rewards dollars have been utilized in order to make funding for these projects work. Weatherization over the years previously explored ways to incorporate solar as a measure. So a small subset of homes have received solar. However, not until this year have we been able to pair this with the US DOE program. Since approval, 5 homes have begun going through the initial pilot phase. In addition, the weatherization network statewide is currently assessing 86,000 individual households for possible future inclusion using the University of Minnesota Solar Suitability app and the PV Watts program. Our hope is to identify additional funding sources that can leverage the US DOE allotment to offer solar on every household we serve that has a suitable solar resource. While Minnesota is one of the first states to add solar as a measure, we have done our research and built our program on data from Colorado's weatherization program. In Colorado, they found that by adding just 2.5 kW, a fairly small solar array to a home, weatherization clients on average tripled their energy reduction by having weatherization plus solar from $200 annually to $600 annually in energy savings. We also hope to expand our weatherization efforts through the Warm Home Initiative by incorporating air source heat pumps. Air source heat pumps are not yet used within the Weatherization Assistance Program. However, Minnesota WAP is exploring ways to expand the current program to meet the needs of specific high energy users, especially in greater Minnesota. A conservation applied research and development study done by the Center for Energy and Environment found that customers with high fuel costs could reasonably save an estimated energy use in cold climates like Minnesota by 47%. With comprehensive weatherization paired with air source heat pumps or solar, that overall average energy savings could be well over 50%. This is truly a one-time infusion for a lasting impact. With that, I will wrap up my presentation by simply saying a huge thank you to the 23 service providers statewide, the hundreds of contractors that make weatherization work every day, and to the legislature and to you all for helping us launch the Healthy Air Program. These tireless workers statewide have served vulnerable Minnesota families throughout Minnesota for over 43 years with a one-time infusion of energy and financial saving measures, improving homes and changing lives. I thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee for your time, and I am available for questions.
Well, Representative Long has the first question. Representative Long.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Ms. Grancy, for the presentation. I just wanted to note, I appreciate you mentioning the solar rewards leveraging that you've been able to do with the program as it exists. We're working hard to try to get an increased solar rewards allocation, and that's one area that has been in both the House and Senate RDA proposals. And so I think we're optimistic that that can happen and hopefully allow you to be able to leverage some of those solar rewards dollars and the weatherization work you're doing. The question I have is that you mentioned the Recovery Act provided an injection of funds in the last economic downturn to the work that you all are doing. We're at a time where we know that the economy is going to need some stimulus likely, and wondering that if there was funding available to put into these programs, do you feel like, as with the Recovery Act, these projects would be considered shovel ready and something that could put people to work in quick order?
Absolutely. And, you know, with the current situation, it has been obviously much more difficult to get into homes. And so we have two initiatives addressing that. One, a work group statewide that is working on COVID appropriate, just like you have lead safe work practices. They are developing COVID-safe work practices for infectious disease and other things that may be coming. We also have the statewide solar assessment of the 86,000 homes, and that's all built on a weatherization network that's been around for 40 years that has certified quality control inspectors, certified auditors, and a really strong network of both staff and contractors. So they ramped up before for ARRA significantly, and I believe we're prepared to do that again.
Representative Long.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That's great news. And I think with ARRA, that was a really significant portion of their investment. I think it was almost $1 in $8 went to weatherization and other renewable energy investments. So hoping that that's something we can consider as we're going forward and looking for ways to boost our economy and keep our solar industry working too, since we know that like many industries, they're seeing some downturn in demand right now. Thank you, Madam Chair.
I have a question too. One of the helpful things for us would be to see the context. You've told us how much work you've done. I don't understand how much needs to be done. And if we have a way of saying, this is how we get the whole job done. Have you all mapped that out or graphed it out?
Yes. So if we were to look at the entire state as far as the need, and I'll gladly share this with you. We have identified that under currently, and this is pre-COVID, there were an estimated 519,000 income-eligible households in Minnesota. 53,000 have been weatherized since 2005, where records of comprehensive weatherization really is where we're looking. 19,000 or 20,000 of those were served during ARRA. About 9% of all eligible households have been weatherized since 2005. And we do have a map across the state based on census data as far as looking at each and every county, how many eligible households there are, and how many have been served. So we have a pretty strong data source and sense of where we're at and where we need to go. Does that answer your question?
Partly. So a map would be, I think, useful for people to see. And if you would send that to us, we will post it on our website. I think, and we'll share it among members too, so folks can see what needs to be done. But it does seem to me that we need to set a goal, a timeline, like 2030, we'll have this many done, so that we know how much we have to invest and what our return will be. So that I think we always need to have that. Where do we need to be? And what's our timeline to get there? Okay. Is that something you have now, or is it something you're thinking about?
Yes, Madam Chair, we have both the average cost per unit, which is around $7,500 per home. And so we can extrapolate that, recognizing that one home may just need some insulation measures, another needs extremely comprehensive. So some may be a $1,500 home expenditure, another may be $8,000 home. But using average numbers, we can extrapolate how many dollars it would take per X number of homes. And if we were to meet all, I mean, we know that currently under current funding, it will take over 200 years to get through all the homes. So obviously any amount of increase there will have a significant impact, and we can certainly break that out for you.
Sometimes when we see numbers like it'll take 200 years, then we do a better job. So I'm thinking of when the Environment Committee looked at how long it would take to get through the various counties to do the atlases that showed how much groundwater there was and what was going to be available. When we saw those trajectories, we got on a much better path, and not I don't want to say when we're going to finish, but I think it's now like 2023. I mean, we changed from this way out year to something that made sense. So I think it's important that you talk to us and about that kind of thing. But I'm not going to ask you another question because Representative Swazinski has one. Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the testifier. So it sounded like your average spend was about $7,500 per house. What was kind of the total, what's your total budget, all funds, federal, state, that's poured into this program?
Yes, so this coming year, we have a doubling of the LIHEAP. There's two different federal funds that come in, so and an increase in weatherization. So with that, we will be at, I believe it's around $23 million that will be coming into the state starting July 1 for the weatherization program year. We have continued to see an increase from the federal government through weatherization each year, but it's been incremental. And if you'd like a breakout, you know, of the last 10 years, we can certainly, I can certainly provide that for you.
Certainly, thank you. And then also, is there a prevailing wage at all with these programs so the workers would get prevailing wage?
I am going to have to double check to see if that is statewide or not. I do know throughout ARA, we did utilize prevailing wage with all measures. I'm not certain if that is the case for all work that's done in the home, so I will double check that from a statewide perspective and send it to you, if that's all right.
Thank you. You can share it with the committee too. Thank you.
Thanks, members. I don't see other hands up. Are there? Okay, I don't see other hands up. Thank you so much for presenting to us. Wish you well in your work. It's really important, and we need to do more. So thank you.
Thank you so much.
The next thing on our agenda is House File 3230, Representative Bowe. Would you want to move your bill and tell us about it?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair and members. I would like to move 3230 forward for consideration for passage and placement in the General Register. This bill is really a clean, easy, nonpartisan, non-controversial bill that really seeks to update old, outdated statutory verbiage. For many years, the state of Minnesota has been requiring our largest utilities to promote the use of fluorescent bulbs and HID lamps for energy-efficient lighting. But then, every year, we spend a small fortune to collect and manage those used bulbs because mercury is in those types of bulbs, and mercury is a potent neurotoxin. So this bill merely seeks to update that verbiage and thereby allow those utilities to promote and encourage LEDs. And LEDs have many positives. They are more energy efficient, they are much longer lasting, and at the end of their lifespan, they are considered non-hazardous. So you don't have to spend that small fortune to manage and recycle those bulbs and lamps. So all of the parties that are impacted by this bill, I've weighed in support, and that includes Xcel Energy as our largest utility, the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, as this is well within their goals of continuing to remove mercury from our environment, and also the 87 counties in Minnesota and all of their household hazardous waste programs that are involved currently in collecting and managing fluorescent bulbs and HID lamps around the state. One of the reasons that I'm doing this as a standalone bill and requesting that is because the Senate companion, SF3331, has passed through their Committee on Energy and Utilities unchanged and is waiting on the Senate floor. And so by allowing this to go through to our House floor unchanged, they will mesh at the end very easily and be done. And so I would once again renew my motion to pass and send 3230 to the General Register. And I appreciate your support, and I'm open to any questions if there are any. Thank you.
Representative Hornstein has a question. Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Not so much a question, but a quick comment. Representative Bowe, thank you for bringing this forward. And as you were talking about mercury and mercury in the waste stream, I recalled that the chair and I worked on this issue many, many years ago. And I just want to take the opportunity, just so everybody knows, the incredible contribution that Chair Wagenius has made to the whole conversation about mercury in the state. Very few people were talking about this in the late 1980s, and she was. And many, many important bills related to mercury reduction, toxic waste reduction, came about as a result of Chair Wagenius's work. And I feel like you're building on that work. And you know, when you talked about a potent neurotoxin, that is a phrase that Chair Wagenius used over and over again to make the case for why we need to pay attention to this. So I want to thank you and Chair Wagenius recognize your incredible, really lifelong work on issue around mercury, which is so prevalent and still needs a lot of attention. So thank you.
Well, thank you, Representative Hornstein, for those kind words. I wasn't expecting them. But we've had a lot of work to do on mercury, and there's still work to be done. Unfortunately, it's not our only neurotoxin either. So, Representative Bowe, you're going to have to expand your portfolio.
I will do that. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Straczynski, you have the next question.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Bowe, just kind of a question for you. Have you had a bill heard in this committee before?
Madam Chair, Representative, I don't believe so. So I'm very proud, and I have donuts right here. So
I was just asking to see if we were expecting a UPS truck or a FedEx truck or a speedy delivery truck to be showing up to our houses later on today, or we could expect that this morning yet. So, but it, just another point, you know, this is our only GOP bill we've had heard in this committee. And I know that because we have a freshman doing it and he hasn't brought snacks. So.
Okay. Other, it's good to see a bill that has bipartisan support. That's always appreciated. Are there other, I don't see other testifiers or other questions. So with that, Representative Bowe renews his motion that House File 3230 be recommended to pass and placed on the general register. And for this, we will have to do a roll call vote.
Chair Wagenius?
Yes.
Representative Long?
Yes.
Representative Straczynski?
Yeah.
Representative Acomb?
Yes.
Representative Baker?
Aye.
Representative Bierman?
Yes.
Representative Bowe?
Yes.
Representative Christensen?
Yes.
Representative Garofalo? Representative Garofalo? Representative Hornstein?
Yes.
Representative Jordan?
Yes.
Representative Mahoney? Representative Mahoney? Representative Meckland?
Aye.
Representative Nelson?
Yes.
Representative Stevenson?
Yes.
Representative Garofalo? There are 12 ayes and 2 absent.
The motion prevails. House File 3230 is passed and placed on the general register. Thank you, Representative Bowe.
Thank you.
So one of the next things because it's so timely right now, we're just going to have a short discussion about COVID-related shutoffs. And Representative Long has arranged for 2 folks to talk about that issue. The first will be Annie Levinson-Falk from Citizens Utility Board. And I'd like to welcome her to the committee.
Annie, if you're watching online, then there's a 30-second delay, so you may want to turn off the monitor.
Can you hear me at all?
Annie,
yes.
If
okay.
You're watching online, then there's a 30-second delay, so you may want to turn off the monitor.
Thank you for that. Is my audio coming through okay?
It is. Please put your name
Good.
On the
Thank
record.
You. I apologize for that. My name is Annie Levinson-Falk. I'm the Executive Director of the Citizens Utility Board of Minnesota, and thank you very much for inviting me today to discuss the issues that people are seeing related to COVID specific to their utility bills. I'm going to do my best to give an overview of what's happened in this regard since the crisis began in Minnesota and the current situation for utility consumers. Overall, we're not yet seeing widespread numbers of customers falling behind on bills or facing shutoffs, but I do fear that that is likely to be coming. And so I'll also discuss some areas where action is going to be needed going forward. This may be obvious, but it's especially crucial that everyone have working power and heat in their home and to comply with the stay-at-home order. When people don't have utility service, they can't refrigerate or cook food in order to remain in their homes. They can't charge their phones and stay connected to loved ones and healthcare providers. People whose water is supplied by wells lose their water supply and their septic service. And kids without electricity can't do distance learning. And it's very reasonable to expect that with the economic impact of the crisis, more people are going to have difficulty affording their bills. So for these reasons, more than 30 states have instituted temporary moratoriums on utility disconnections. We don't have that kind of a shutoff moratorium in Minnesota, but instead the Public Utilities Commission and the Department of Commerce asked all utilities for voluntary actions. And they asked our utilities to do three things. They asked them to extend the cold weather rule of protections related to disconnections and reconnections, to waive late fees that residential and small business customers incur because of the economic circumstances related to the pandemic, and to arrange payment plans for customers who request help that are based on the financial resources and the circumstances of the individual customer. And they asked utilities to publicly file their responses to this request with the PUC. So I'd like to just clarify exactly what it means to say that a utility is extending the cold weather rule protections. It's not the same thing as saying that a customer won't be disconnected. A lot of people think that your service can't be shut off during the winter, and that's not true. What the cold weather rule says is that a utility can't disconnect service to a customer if certain criteria are met. If the household income is at or below 50% of the state median, if the household depends on that utility service for their heat, and they make a payment plan and they keep up on that plan. So if a household makes too much money or doesn't depend on the utility service for their heat, or if they don't arrange a payment plan or they miss a payment, then they can be disconnected under the cold weather rule, and customers are disconnected each winter. So the PUC and Department of Commerce request for voluntary action falls short of a moratorium on shutoff. And while the request addresses a big part of the immediate need, it doesn't yet consider the longer term issues like when the emergency is lifted and the cold weather protections are no longer in place, are we going to see a spike in shutoff? So like I said, Minnesota utilities have been filing their responses to this request publicly. By my count, the responses of at least 26 of the cooperative and municipal utilities do fall short of agreeing to all of what was requested. And that doesn't mean that they're shutting people off, but it is hard to tell because unlike the investor-owned utilities, co-ops and munis don't report numbers on shutoff, their customers in arrears, or other information that would allow us or policymakers to see if there's a growing trend in customers that are having trouble. That said, I do not think that we're having widespread problems with unpaid bills or disconnection at this time, which is which is good. And I think there's a few reasons for that. Even though there's not a universal policy, a lot of utilities are extending a lot of extra flexibility right now. And I do want to make sure to recognize what they're doing. Those efforts are definitely helping. People have access to unemployment. They have their stimulus payments, and there's energy assistance with some relaxed requirements right now, and those are helping. And largely, I think it's just too early because of the timing of utility bill cycles. It could take a couple of months for the impacts to appear. But I am quite afraid that a problem is coming down the road. Like I said, when the emergency is lifted, our utility is going to resume disconnections. Our customer is going to be required to pay off their past due bills immediately or within, you know, just a few months. People are going to need time to recover. A lot of it, of course, is going to depend on how long this pandemic lasts. If we continue to head into a serious recession, as is seeming pretty likely at this point, we're likely to see more people falling behind on their utility bills and facing shutoffs. I do believe that a moratorium on disconnections is appropriate and important, and the Citizens Utility Board joined with MnCap, EnergySense, and Legal Aid in calling for a moratorium, as well as some additional measures to ensure that people's utilities stay on and that they have the time that they'll need to get back to current on their bills when the emergency is lifted. I understand the perspective that maybe a shutoff moratorium isn't needed right now because we're not seeing major problems. I would argue that we can reasonably expect problems coming and that a pandemic is a time when it's much better to be safe than sorry. But if we just focus on looking forward, there are other things that the legislature can do that will be very helpful. One is increased funding for energy assistance and possibly programs like weatherization that you discussed earlier. Another thing that would be a major help is having more transparency into the situation. So simple reporting from the co-ops and municipal utilities on things like the number of customers who are disconnected, the number of customers who've received disconnect notices, that'd be really helpful. Without this kind of reporting, it's very difficult to know when customers outside of the major utility areas are having trouble and to kind of spot those trends early on. Like I said, investor-owned utilities already report these things regularly, but I believe that policymakers need to be able to see when people in the smaller towns are unable to get necessary utility service. And I would also ask the committee to remember that 12% of Minnesota households that depend on propane or other delivered fuels, those services aren't covered by the cold weather rule or those kinds of protections, and they may need some special attention. So with that, I'll conclude, but I'd be happy to take questions or to talk more about any piece of this if the chair would like.
I see a question from Representative Hornstein. Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Ms. Levinson-Falk, and I really appreciate your work on this. My question relates to the existing statutes around utility shutoffs, which, you know, I understand are, you know, it's the cold weather rule. To your knowledge, are there people falling through the cracks? I mean, even in the winter months, are there still shutoffs happening? And if so, what is the recourse?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Hornstein. If you look, like I said, the investor-owned utilities file reports, I believe, weekly during the cold weather rule period so that you can see what's going on there. Each utility, you know, treats it slightly differently. And obviously, just because someone is behind on their bill, there's no requirement to shut people off. So they are able to, you know, they don't have to do that. But you do see, if you look at the reports, that not all of the customers, first of all, that request cold weather rule protection are granted it. They're being denied for one reason or another. And not all of the customers who are in arrear, you know, some people are getting disconnected. There are people that fall through the cracks. There are procedures if somebody wants to, you know, formally contest being denied protection or the reason for their shutoff, they can contact the Public Utilities Commission and their procedures for that. But people do get shut off during the winter.
Madam Chair, just a quick follow-up. Do we have a sense of, you know, how many Minnesotans are literally freezing in the dark during the winter months? I mean, this is, you know, I think first and foremost, if this is some sort of a loophole or the, you know, there seems to be reasons why it's happening. I mean, no one should be denied this basic need in a Minnesota winter. Do we have a sense at all of what the numbers are?
Madam Chair and Representative, we do have numbers for the investor-owned utilities, and I believe Dakota Electric, because it's chosen to be regulated by the PUC. The locally regulated, you know, the co-ops and unions, we don't have numbers for those. So, I mean, and just to add a little bit of context, you know, reasons that I see that people may be falling through the cracks include something like maybe they had a payment arrangement and they missed a payment, or, you know, sometimes people don't make a payment arrangement and they fall through the cracks for that reason. There's a lot of kind of like individual circumstances at play. But there are people who are falling through the cracks. I could get you those numbers for the IOUs if you'd be interested to see them.
Thank you. I would very much. And again, thanks for your work on this.
Thank you. Representative Long has the next question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks for helping us get a fuller picture of the risk that we know a number of Minnesotans are on right now with the economic downturn and their possibility that folks may not be able to pay their energy bills in this difficult time. Can you just give a little bit of flavor for, you know, with the transparency from the Public Utilities Commission and Commerce Department requests, are you seeing that almost everybody has committed to their request for not shutting people off, or were you, with some of the reviews of the filings, do you think that some utilities are falling short of that commitment?
Madam Chair, Representative Long, most of the utilities are committing to all of what was requested. There are, like I said, I counted 26 utilities that had filed that are, and for the most part, they leave a part of the request out, that they're just silent on that. So I'm not sure what to make of that. I can't say for sure that they aren't complying with that part of the request, but it does look strange when you see a lot of filings where they have literally copied and pasted the text from the request and a piece of it is missing. So that's where I say that some of them are falling short. That's usually what happens. And the most common area is where is in regards to people who are currently shut off or were shut off prior to the crisis, getting them reconnected to service. That's the most common area that I see utilities being silent on. There are a smattering of utilities too that have not yet filed their responses. They're still kind of trickling in, and I understand that for you know, municipal and cooperative utilities, filing stuff with the PUC is not something that they're used to doing. So I understand why some of those are late, but there are a handful of utilities that we don't have their policies yet.
Okay. Thank you. And one further question. I'm just, when we're looking to the hopeful end of the emergency and thinking about the, you know, folks who are going to be potentially have some utility payment debt that they're going to need to pay off, what are you seeing in terms of commitments from utilities about flexibility on payment plans, and what else do you think could be helpful there?
Madam Chair and Representative, I think it's a little early to see what the utilities are planning on that. I'm not aware if there are a lot of plans for after the crisis or after the emergency is lifted. I think people are going to need some time to get back to current. So I've seen a few of the utilities that filed said that they'll give people 3 months. That's going to be insufficient for a lot of people. If you think about, you know, you're behind on your utility bill, you're probably also behind on maybe your mortgage, maybe your car payment, maybe your credit card, and all of those things are going to come due. If you're lucky, when the emergency is lifted, maybe if you're out of work, maybe you can get back to work, but you don't have that money in savings that's ready to go yet. So I think a minimum of having at least 12 months to pay those off, but really it's preferable for the utilities to continue to work individually with customers like they're used to doing, and make payment arrangements that work for the particular household situation.
Thank you. Are there, okay, Representative Aikum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I had a question. You were talking a little bit about the delivered fuels and propane, and that 12% of Minnesotans rely upon that. And while we're not going into the heating season now, this whole economic position that we're in is probably going to last a while. And so I'm curious, knowing how expensive it is to fill propane and the cost barriers to those people who are going to be, who may be economically challenged in the fall and going into the winter, are there programs now in place to help with the cost of propane for people who need it? And just wondering if there's anything that's set in place now, or if those are things that we really do need to be looking at.
And Madam Chair and Representative Akam, propane is not my specialty. I believe that you can use energy assistance to help with your propane, and I think you have another speaker who can talk more about energy assistance than I can on the specifics to that. Propane isn't subject to utility regulation or the laws that apply to utilities, so things like cold weather rule and those kind of things don't apply. It's more up to the individual propane provider how they're going to, you know, manage the relationship with their customer. So it's kind of a different world, legally speaking.
Understood. Thanks.
Okay. Representative Baker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to maybe appreciate Ms. Levinson-Falk's comments, but I also want to make sure we're not looking for problems that don't exist and having some assumptions there that the co-ops and the munis are not being flexible because you don't have that information. I will tell you firsthand, I have visited with many of them in our area in rural Minnesota. They were one of the first ones to the front lines to tell their members, we are here for you and we will delay your payments. So I just want to make sure that anybody listening on the phone, we don't think as a group, as a whole anyway, that we are suggesting that the munis and the co-ops, because they're not responding quickly to the PUC, which is something they're not required to do, that they are not absolutely doing everything they can to work with their customers. So I don't think that's what you're intending to say, Ms. Levinson-Falk, but I want to make sure our munis and co-ops get the credit that they do, because they really, really have stepped up in their local communities with a lot of food shelf donations and stopping the bills and stopping the connections. And so I just wanted to make sure that was on the record as well. I hope that we're not just out searching for problems that may be there, but we don't know. And we need to make sure we get the facts, because our time right now has really got to be focused on hitting the hard facts of what we can do to, if we do have a problem, let's find it. But let's not just do a broad swath of this and assume that because we have a few that maybe have been having an issue, we have to deal with it more with legislation. So just wanted to put that out there for the munis and co-ops. Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam.
Yes, Mrs. Levinson-Falk.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Baker. And I certainly agree with that. I apologize if I suggested that the munis and co-ops were not, doing everything they can to work with their customers. I think when I said that a lot of the utilities, probably all of them, are extending flexibility, and that especially goes too for the small munis and co-ops. And I understand that doing things like, you know, waiving late fees or, saying it's okay, we'll wait to get your payment on that bill can be difficult too. So I do definitely appreciate what the utilities are doing and agree that, you know, we really want to see what are the actual facts and be able to act on those.
Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just, a comment. I've read an article or two that said, on average, utilities across the state, potentially even just cooperatives who have locally elected boards, see defaults and people just walking away to the tune of about $55 million per year. And so, with the extension of the COVID, the shutoffs and the rest, I've heard expectations that number could climb up to about $300 million essentially of unpaid utility bills across the state, where people just say, we're not, and they move out of the jurisdiction or they do whatever. Has there been any talk within the Commerce Department about lessening regulation on utilities because of that essential loss of $300 million in revenue? Because I think that's, those costs are going to get borne by everyone else. And we want to do a, help folks who are right that are being impacted, but also, you know, if we're impacting them by raising their costs because they have to pay someone else's bill, that's not necessarily right either. So just kind of putting that out there, because I know that there's, you know, these are real things. There's costs at the cooperative level. They're buying from on long-term contracts from big generators. And so those costs do get bore by someone. So I was just kind of making that point, just seeing if anything, if the Commerce Department's looking at that, or if the PUC is looking at that as far as the unpaid bills that could pass on to other people. Thanks.
Ms. Levinson-Falk, did you want to respond? No. Any other testifiers or questions? Well, thank you for being with us. And the next on the agenda is Bill Grant from Minnesota Community Action Partnership.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can you hear me?
We can.
Thank you. Again, Bill Grant with the Minnesota Community Action Partnership. And we're the statewide association that represents the 24 community action agencies that serve all 87 counties in Minnesota. And many of those community action agencies provide energy assistance to low-income Minnesotans in nearly every county throughout the state. We are fortunate going into this pandemic to have had a mild winter and a pretty strong economy. So applications for assistance had been running a little behind average. And so our situation going into the pandemic was a strong one in terms of resources available in the energy assistance program. And since April 1st, as we know, the weather has been relatively mild. And as Ms. Levinson-Falk reported, utilities, with minor exceptions, have not shut off customers as requested by the Commerce Department and the Public Utilities Commission. A somewhat greater concern has been with delivered fuel customers, propane and fuel oil. And we have seen that some of those vendors have refused to fill tanks without cash on delivery, or an EAP payment, energy assistance payment, already in hand. And I'll remind you, it's still the heating season in northern Minnesota, where propane and fuel oil are much more prevalent as heating sources. And many use these fuels to heat domestic hot water in their homes. And for people that are, for everyone, of course, that are forced to be at home more these days, having access to a reliable source of hot water is not only a privilege, but it's also a necessity for maintaining sanitary living conditions. Larger concern that I have is what happens as the crisis deepens and many more people struggle to pay utility bills. We are expecting new energy assistance program money that passed with the CARES Act, and that will help many people. But many others will struggle to pay and stay current with their utility bills and avoid shutoffs. And I believe that the legislature and or the governor will need to keep the moratorium option open and under consideration as we move forward, and as the willingness of utilities and fuel vendors to float customers for month after month begins to wane. The EAP dollars, the energy assistance dollars that passed with the CARES Act, that passed on March 27th. We still haven't seen that money arrive in Minnesota. It's been 41 days. For those of you that are listening to this call, and I know many utilities are listening that have influence on this matter with the Department of Health and Human Services, many others that could weigh in on this, That's an unconscionable length of time to wait during an emergency for these kinds of funds to arrive in the states. And I would ask that those that do have an opportunity to be heard on that do so, because every day that that we wait for the money to arrive is a day that we get closer to running out of the money that we do have available to serve Minnesotans, and a day closer we get to not being able to meet the needs of both utility customers and the utilities themselves who depend on energy assistance payments to have customers remain current as much as possible with their bills. So with that, Madam Chair, I'd be happy to take any questions that members might have.
Representative Long has the first question.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for your presentation, Mr. Grant, for the excellent work that all of your members do. Just want to dig in a little bit on the delay in funding for the disbursement from the federal government. Do you have a sense for why that is, or what's holding it up at this point?
Madam Chair and Representative Long, I wish I knew. The Department of Health and Human Services, it's been radio silent on when and when we'll receive those dollars. There have been repeated requests from our national partners and others to determine the timing of the receipt of those funds, and we've received no reply, basically, from HHS to those requests.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Follow up, can you put in some context what the current situation is for the funding, and you know, how urgently the need is to have these disbursements from the federal government?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Long. As I mentioned, we're fortunate in that we had a mild winter and applications were running somewhat behind the average year. And so we came into the pandemic with some resources on hand to be able to address the applications that we've been seeing, let's say, since April 1st. As I understand it, you know, we should be good if money arrives by June 1st. After that, we begin to get in trouble.
Thank you.
I don't see any other hands raised. Thank you, Mr. Grant. Are there any other questions before or notes before we end? I see Representative Long would like to be recognized.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. If we're wrapping up, I just wanted to make a comment. I believe that this may be your last hearing, potentially, unless we have a unique special session hearing, and wanted to, I don't know what number hearing this is for you, but I do want to note that in addition to chairing ably the Energy and Climate Committee, in the past you've chaired the Environment Finance Committee, the Transportation Committee, the State Taxes Committee, and the Judiciary Committee. And according to our library services, this is your 12,176th day of service.
Oh, good grief.
The state of Minnesota. So you have had a tremendous legacy to, I think, the people of Minnesota, both on the environment, your work on water issues, your work on clean energy this session. It's been, I think, a personal honor to get to serve with you on this committee. And I just wanted to express our thanks for your years of service and for the milestone of this being your last committee hearing.
Well, I thank you for the kind remarks. I think one of the things that this whole difference that we're sitting here doing remote, chatting remotely, COVID has taught us not to ignore science. And I hope that's a lesson that the legislature takes going forward, because I think that's huge. So I like science, so that's why I say that. Thank you all for your attention here this morning. And
Madam Chair, you have two more hands up, I think.
Oh my gosh, you're right. Representative Hornstein, I totally ignored my nice Google Doc, huh?
Well, thank you. And I just want to add to Representative Long's comments. I know I talked earlier about your work on mercury, but I just want to say on a personal note that we first met 32 years ago when I was an organizer for Clean Water Action, and you were just starting your legislative career. And, you know, I consider you a mentor, and I've learned so much from you. It just seems that every issue that I've been involved in, you've been incredibly helpful, incredibly supportive and insightful. And so I want to just thank you for that. And I know that you're going to continue to be very active on the issues that we care about. And I look forward to our continued work together. But just a big from the heart thank you for all you've done and helped me personally on understanding so many complex environmental issues. And I appreciate that.
Thank you, Representative. You all didn't need to do this. Representative Akam.
I just wanted to take a second and I also thank you so much. As a first-term legislator, you have been so incredibly generous to me, as I would also say as a mentor, and you, I think, have really conducted the Energy and Climate Committee in such a collaborative way to those of us that have been new. I'm so grateful to your experience and your just your leadership. And so thank you for all you've done. I'm thrilled to have been able to serve with you this term, and that we were able to serve on a committee that includes climate. And so thank you for being the leader of that. So anyway, I appreciate the opportunity to work with you.
Well, thank you all for all those nice comments. I appreciate them. I know you all are going to do terrific work going forward. We laid a good ground for lots of accomplishments. So with that, this remote meeting is adjourned. Thank you all.